Karen Hoopitt will be part of a panel discussion on Tuesday, April 9th at 5:30 at the John Jay School of Criminal Justice. For more information about it and to RSVP, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, the award-winning author Alexander Himon talks about growing up in Sarajevo and watching the destruction from its destruction from Chicago during the Balkan War. And then later on, Dr. Robert Lustig explains how the massive amount of sugar we are consuming has changed our brain chemistry, affecting what we eat and how much of it we have. And he suggests ways that we can balance our diets once again. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from the MacArthur Theater Center in Princeton, presenting Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale, April 2nd through April 21st. Tickets and information available at 609-258-2787 or MacArthur.org. 13. Presenting NYC Arts, Thursdays at 8 p.m. This week, a glimpse into the life of Fabio Luisi, the principal conductor of the Metropolitan Opera. NYC Arts, tonight at 8 p.m. Anne, a new Broadway play starring Holland Taylor as Ann Richards, the former governor of Texas, now extended through September 1st at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater. Visit telecharge.com.
Think of how much you value the news, conversations, and cultural programs you hear on WNYC. Now consider passing that gift to a new generation. A legacy created through your will, qualified retirement plan, or life insurance policy keeps WNYC strong and growing. Call 646-829-4587 or email legacygiving at wnyc.org.
Alexander Himon is considered one of our finest writers of fiction, but he's turned to nonfiction for his latest book. He's called it The Book of My Lives, and in it he writes of growing up in Sarajevo, of the war that tore the country apart, the former Yugoslavia, and displaced friends and family as well as himself. And he writes of making a new home in Chicago. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Alexander Himon back to our show. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here again.
This book is being described as not quite a memoir. Did you approach it differently than you might have if you were writing a traditional memoir?
Well, I don't know what a traditional memoir is. Churchill wrote a memoir, and I grew up reading memoirs of concentration camp survivors. Memoir has come to mean here mainly confessional or addiction memoir, and that I have a resistance to that because there's a particular narrative trajectory in those memoirs where, you know, it starts with sin and then ends with redemption. And it's crypto-religious, and that to me, it's repulsive.
And so, there's no redemption in this book.
No, but there's no sin either. I mean, I don't believe in those things. So to me, it's a collection of true stories in more ways than one and some personal essays.
Well, how much of your fiction is based in some ways on your own life and experiences?
Well, the way that I write fiction is I would call it the what-if approach. So that, you know, I might have an incident that did take place in my life, but then the story comes out coming into existence after I ask myself, what if? That is, what if this happened in this particular situation? So that, for instance, in one of my books, there's a story about a young boy who goes to buy a freezer for his family. I did do that, but everything else in the story I made up because I asked myself, what if? What if this happens to him? And so in that sense, I don't see fiction as autobiographical because to me it is the alternative path from the point of in my life that, you know, I experienced, but it went in entirely different direction.
Well, in this case, obviously, you're writing what was.
Right.
And you write heartbreakingly and vividly about your young daughter who was diagnosed with a very rare form of brain cancer and of her grueling treatment and death. That was originally published in The New Yorker, wasn't it?
That is correct. Yes.
So had you written that as a chapter for this book when it was published in The New Yorker, or had you written it as an essay that you decided you would want to include in a book like this?
Well, I had written most of the other pieces before, and many of them had been published in The New Yorker. I didn't write it as a chapter, but once I wrote it, and I was waiting for the critical mass of pieces to accumulate so I could make it into a book, I always knew that would be the last chapter in the book. It's not the last piece I wrote, but it's the last chapter.
During Isabel's illness, your older daughter, Ella, created an imaginary brother named Mingus, named after the jazz musician?
Yes, we suggested the name.
What does this reveal about the way people tell stories? Do you see some people as being natural storytellers? Is there a genetic thing that happened there?
I would like to think that, but I think it's evolutional. I think that we, at some point, a narrative instinct kicks in, which is closely connected with language instinct, so that there's an acquisition of language needs storytelling. There's a narrative aspect to that. But also, I think we as a species, this is where literature comes from, I think. We process our experience by converting the mass of impressions and sensations and experiences and the confusing pieces of our experience that we have a hard time putting together in our head. We process it by converting it into a story on a very basic level. I don't mean literary story necessarily, but just telling it to other people. And so what my daughter did is process her experience and our experience of Isabel's illness and death by assigning some of those things to Mingus.
The Book of My Lives begins in Sarajevo. That's the city you grew up in. That's under
right.
Tito.
Right. Tito died in 1980, so I had a few more years before I left.
You also write vividly about the later years there in your early 20s when socialism was giving way to what you call fascism. Fascism, or was it a kind of a renewed nationalism as the country broke apart?
Well, I mean, it was extreme nationalism that required operations of ethnic cleansing that had to be, you know, required the new nation states to be born in bloods, and that blood was built into national mythologies. And that's, of course, what fascism is. Fascism, there's no international fascism, there's only national fascism. So all fascist movements were always extremely nationalistic. So in that sense, it complied with the definition. It does comply what happened in forming this line.
And this is the period that's leading up to the terrible wars right. that we saw mostly in Bosnia, but Croatia as well, later Kosovo.
Right.
Were you sure at the time that this was going to lead to war?
Well, funny, the way that the human mind works is funny, because I knew everything that I needed to know, and yet you just knowing facts or having information does not convert it, does not constitute knowledge. And so I had all the facts, but my mind could not imagine and accept the outcome of our lives, my life, being taken apart.
And you say that you and your friends coped with the growing tension in a kind of euphoria.
There's
I always associate euphoria with a happy feeling.
Well, it was kind of a disaster euphoria where, you know, a lot of social constraints were dismissed as meaningless because there was a looming catastrophe. And so when we were all young and the best partying I've ever experienced was in the summer of 91 when the war in Croatia started, and it's the summer before the war in Bosnia.
You describe retreating to your family's cabin in the mountains. Was that an important time for you in developing as a writer?
It was, because I read compulsively. I read War and Peace, which is 1,000 pages in a week or so. I read all the fat books that I had no patience to read in the city. And I lived with my parents, and they would not let me read for 8 hours a day. But I was also writing. I was... that summer in 91, or the fall, in fact, I was writing a book because I thought I need to write a book before the war starts, so in case I'm shot, I would leave something behind. So that book, fortunately, never got published and vanished. It's one of the least important victims of the war.
But it being away from the tension, can you really escape?
No, because one day I woke up and I saw military police, doing exercises with gas masks on their faces right outside the cabin. And my dog, who I let him out early when I woke up, was running up and down the hill with the military police. And so, you know, I had to walk out in my slippers and rope and run with the military police trying to get the dog to come back.
That's the dog named Mech?
That's right.
Mech, who actually wound up coming to Canada with the rest of your family.
That's right. Yeah.
You write a lot about Mech.
Well, Mech is, you know, he's a member of our family. So when my parents came over to Canada in 1993, and my sister, and so they brought Mac over after some difficult decision-making, whether to leave him or take him along, and they took him along. And so my parents left nearly everything behind, and the only thing from their previous life that they had was Mac, and Mac was a loyal and good dog.
Now, you were in Chicago already. Right. Could they have come to the United States?
No, because I didn't have the papers, and I was still in my application for alien card or the green card. Alien registration card was still pending, and I had no money or any standing to bring them over. And so they went through the Canadian immigration program, and they were accepted, so they went to Canada.
My guest is Alexander Hemon, whose latest book is the Book of My Lives, with an S at the end. When you were in college, you got in trouble for organizing a tongue-in-cheek theme party with your friends, and you were then summoned by the state security offices and interrogated. What happened there? Had you been informed on?
Well, we had this organized this party for a birthday party for one of our friends. She organized it, and the theme was it was supposed to imitate the Nazi parties as rendered in the old communist movies. And so,
I could see where some people might be made uneasy by that.
No, of course, and I can see it too. But we were just. We thought that would be evident. It's not serious. Anyway, the state security sent a few people in who just showed up. They were not invited, and they were sitting in our conversations. And we had ideas about that were not Nazi ideas, but rather ideas about multi-party system and getting rid of the Tito cult and all that. And the state security was promptly informed about all of our conversations. So when I was interrogated, they knew who was there, who said what, the whole thing. That was the scariest thing that there was.
And what were they trying to gain by this?
It is not clear to me to this day. There were a number of serious political scandals going on in former Yugoslavia. And also Bosnia had less, fewer dissidents and fewer opposing political personalities. So they were kind of trying to break our back and warn others not to, meddle in any kind of ideas about democracy.
You mentioned that people there will ask you what you are, a Serb, which would make you probably a member of the Orthodox Church, or Croat, which would mean that you're a Catholic. But you call yourself a Bosnian, which I think most people would say would mean, at least in code, that you're a Muslim. You're not a Muslim.
No. Bosnian is a citizenship, not an ethnicity. Bosnian Muslims, or people of Muslim background who are Bosnian, they would call themselves Bosniaks, with K at the end. Bosnian is a citizenship like American. So, the way I identify myself here as American, I identify myself as Bosnian. So that my loyalties are not determined by my birth. It's an allegiance by choice.
And you resist doing that, playing that other game.
Yes, because the question is racist, isn't it? If you know what your ethnicity is, then we know what you think.
And whether you're a friend or a foe.
Right, but also all your ideas are already predetermined. You cannot discuss them, so.
One professor of yours became a high-ranking member of the Serbian Democratic Party, which was led by Radovan Karadzic. Did that come as a surprise to you?
It came as a complete surprise because he was my favorite professor in college and was very good as a professor. After I graduated, I called him up and we took a walk by the river discussing literature. And then a year after that, he was sitting next to Karadzic in press conferences.
Well, a lot of those, the people who we now think of war criminals, had surprisingly earlier professions. Karadzic was also a poet.
Not a very good one, but he was a neuropsychiatrist, too.
He was a psychiatrist. We usually assume a psychiatrist would not become a war criminal.
Well, there were actually a few more than Karadzic war criminals, but there was also, in Serbian leadership, there was a philosophy professor who was a Kant expert. I had another professor who I didn't like who is said to have been photographed kicking a human head like a soccer ball. So it was not, the war was represented as savagery, but there were quite a few intellectuals on all sides, but particularly Serbian side, who were ideologues and who, formulated the program that was then pursued by military means.
And then you came to America and found yourself trapped here?
I was supposed to fly back on May 1st, 1992, and the siege of Sarajevo commenced really on May 2nd when all the exits to the city were closed. And before that, I had decided not to go, that I would have to stay. I was waiting for as long as I could to make the decision.
Well, you obviously have a lot of affection for the city you were in, Chicago. But did you feel stranded at the time?
I felt out of place, yes. I had no way to go get back. So in that sense, I was stranded. But I realized that I would have to stay in Chicago for a very long time, very possibly for the rest of my life. And so I had to contend with that. One of the consequences of that is that I had to acquire English, or enough English to write in it.
And pretty much all of your published writings have been in English, haven't they?
Well, yes, except I wrote a column in Bosnian for many years, since 96 to 2010, and I have quite a few columns published, and two books of columns is published in Bosnia.
Well, in writing this book, which takes place both in Bosnia and in Chicago, did you find yourself thinking more in Serbo-Croatian when you were writing about the earlier years and then in English when you're in Chicago?
No. Whatever I wrote in, I wrote it and I thought in the language that I was writing it in. So when I wrote columns in Bosnia, I thought, and I was writing columns about Chicago and the United States in Bosnia, I would think in Bosnia. When I write in English, I think in English.
You wrote a piece in Chicago listing reasons that you don't want to leave Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago over New York or Los Angeles or Boston or Washington or
yes.
San Francisco?
Yes, any day. Well, at this time, I've lived there for 21 years, and the way I like to live my life requires connection with a lot of people, which takes many, many years.
Well, there are two things you missed tremendously when you moved to America, chess and soccer, but they're played in Chicago.
Oh, well, I play soccer two or three times a week. Chess has become meaningless with computer programs that can beat a master, and they cost $20.
But it took you a while to actually find the right people to do those things?
It did take a few years, but once I found people to play soccer with, I never let them go.
Have you returned to Sarajevo?
Yes, a number of times. Yes.
How do you find it? Is it still a place you knew and loved and felt at home in for all of your early years?
Well, it's changed in very dramatic ways. The war changes people, changes landscapes, and changes the spirit of the city. At the same time, a lot of my friends and places and things I know are still there. So when I go back, I see the new things, but I also see the old things. I see the old friends, but I also have new friends, people who became friends after the war. So I don't go for nostalgic reasons to walk the memory lane. I go there to see specific people and do specific things.
When did your parents leave? Was it when the fighting broke out or afterward?
They left Sarajevo on May 2nd when the siege started, but they went to my grandparents' house. My grandparents were dead, and they spent that summer of 92 there. And then my mother got sick, and they went to northern Serbia, where I had some uncles. And from there, they went to Canada.
Because it was rather difficult to get out of the country at that time, wasn't it?
It was, yes. And there was a number of refugees coming through. And so, you know, all the exits, as it were, out of country were clogged.
They got on the last train out of Sarajevo?
Right.
So it's also very lucky because they might have thought, well, we'll get the one tomorrow.
Well, yeah, in fact, because the train would not leave for a couple of days, and they would go to the train station, then go back home. There was already shooting and shelling. And my mother said, I'm not going. And my father said, let's try one more time. And that train left.
Now, you've written a lot of nonfiction, first in Bosnian, but in recent times in English. Are you going to go back to fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I have several projects in the pipe. To me, it's all storytelling, fiction or nonfiction. There are just different limits to the stories, as it were. So I have a few more true stories to tell, and they would be nonfiction. But also I'm making up stories.
And by the way, Alexander Himon will be speaking with Wen Guanghuang, who was on our show yesterday, and reading tonight at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. For ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. He'll also be speaking with Colin McCann, another one of my favorite writers, tomorrow at 7 o'clock at McNally Jackson. That's at 52 Prince Street. His latest book, The Book of My Lives, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And I thank you for being on our show again.
Thank you. My pleasure.